Eight Nights, copyright 2013 by John Speed.
Night 4. So those wayward thoughts that run through our minds when we light the candles and sing the blessings, I believe that those are the true unspoken prayers of our hearts. I believe that the Lord hears those unspoken prayers more clearly than any that we say aloud. And I want so much for the unspoken prayer of my heart to be pure and worthy in the sight of the Lord, but typically my unspoken prayers go more like this. Wish I had one of those latkes, or she looks hot, or what if I get cancer, or, well, you know the sort of things I mean. I want to be one of those true lovers of the Lord whose heart is filled with simple praise. I've met some of those people. I wish I were one. I wish. Now, in the history of the world, no city has been more influential than Jerusalem, and no building more important than Solomon's Temple. Yes, the back window of your pickup may still have a faded decal of the Twin Towers of the big bald eagle head in the background and an American flag, but I'll bet the words "never forget" are starting to fade. Some diehard Texans might still remember the Alamo, but do they remember that it was a monastery? Do they remember which order built it and when? I'm about to describe a building that has been destroyed for 2,600 years, but it's one building that has never been forgotten. In many ways, it's more influential today than when it was destroyed. And doesn't need a decal or a catchphrase. Three times a day, Orthodox Jews pray the Amida, prayers for the temple's restoration. Christians, too, remember it as they read the Passion story every year. The memory of the temple burns through great swaths of history. The Masons based their secrets on the temple. Whole libraries of mystical claptrap about its construction. The Knights Templar, who in the Middle Ages actually created a sort of uber-government, similar to what conspiracy geeks imagined the UN to be doing in modern times. They based their order out of the remains of Solomon's Temple. The Temple Mount is one of the most fought-over pieces of land on the planet. You can't count the souls or measure the blood that has fallen there. That ancient site has changed hands too many times to count. The Jews, at least at this point in their history, were not a religion. Not in the way we think about religions today. There was no way to opt in or opt out of being a Jew. You had to be a Jew because you were born a Jew. Jews were bound to Hashem by blood and blood alone. Jews were a family, and that family was inescapably ruled by its deity. The creation of Solomon's Temple in Jerusalem was the Jews' defining moment. I choose that word carefully, defining. The temple's creation defined them. And after the temple was destroyed, its destruction defined them. And it continued to define them for the rest of time. There is no other religion like Judaism, no other society like the Jews, and no other building like the temple, and no other event like its destruction. None. So, in the story of the great miracle, Jerusalem and the temple are characters as important as Hashem himself. So we're going to backtrack a little, and I'm going to fill in that backstory. Now, for me, it's interesting to have gotten to this point of the story at last. Up until now, about 99% of the stories had to come straight out of the Old Testament. There simply are no other sources. But we finally got to the point where there are additional sources. So now the story gets richer and deeper. And in an oblique way, we have King David to thank for this. What's happening to the nature of the story, in effect, is the same thing that began happening to Israel, thanks to the changes David introduced. Non-Jewish influences began intermingling with Jewish society. In just a few years, David completely transformed Jewish society. Before David, the Jews were mostly tribal, mostly nomadic, mostly isolated, mostly living in fear of their neighbors, mostly poor. And then David created the nation of Israel. He united all the tribes of Israel under one monarchy. He beat hell out of the Philistines, then he beat hell out of the rest of Israel's neighbors. United under David, Israel became a military force to be reckoned with. Israel took a lot of loot from the Philistines and then started getting lots of tribute from its neighbors. David spread the wealth among his people. He was a generous king. So poor old Israel became not so badly off Israel. The Jews had never before had a ruling king. The first king, Saul, had been so busy scrambling on battlefields trying to keep his struggling kingship alive, he never really had time to rule. But the victorious David brought the Ark to Jerusalem, and he established for the Jews, for the first time, a central government. And even though there were still tribes following their flocks around, they now had a government, and the government was staying put. Not only that, the tabernacle was staying put too. So David had established both a political and spiritual nexus for the Jews. And anywhere the political and the spiritual get nexused, the commercial quickly nexuses right along beside it. David's government had a lot of cash. Cash looted from its defeated enemies, and David started spending it, building, as kings with cash like to do. He built a magnificent palace. He started fortifying. He fortified the hell out of everything. That meant building walls and towers and moats and redoubts. He formed a standing army and armed them. He stationed troops at strategic locations. He doubled the height of the walls of Jerusalem. He expanded Jerusalem's water supply and built a siege-proof network of underground tunnels that carried water from the area's many springs. And water still runs through them. You can walk through them beneath the city today. He turned what had been a graveyard into an actual city. Because the tabernacle now lived in Jerusalem constantly and consistently, and because the law required every Jew to visit the tabernacle at least 3 times a year, Jerusalem needed permanent ways to accommodate visitors, inns with rooms and food, and these popped up overnight. You know, the laws of economics, demand creates supply. And since they were empty during the non-festival times, you know, the laws of economics, supply creates demand. People had 3 reasons a year to go to Jerusalem because there was so much going on there, and they soon found even more reasons. So shop owners and craftsmen and builders and soldiers, they and their families began flocking to David's holy city. To help all his flocking, David built roads throughout his kingdom, radiating from Jerusalem like threads of a spider web. He built a big main road, the King's Road. Every kingdom eventually gets a King's Road. From Israel's northern tip to its southern border, the King's Road in Jerusalem sat smack in the center of everything. And then David thus began one of those golden ages. Every great kingdom has a golden age at the start of a rich peace, when there's more work than people, when there's more than enough money to go around, and this was Israel's. Money began to pour through Jerusalem. They don't call it liquidity for nothing. Money flows. Nothing changes a desert like liquidity. Think of what happened to the dry Middle East once OPEC got started. And that was just a monetary change. Now imagine adding unquestioned military superiority to that river of money. David had, after all, made Israel a superpower. So go ahead, imagine what a fast-flowing, churning river of money would do to an insular society of hardscrabble farmers and nomad herders, and all this in the space of 20 years. David's changes drastically altered the daily life of the Jews. Their nomadic agricultural economy quickly became a stationary market economy. They made money by selling and buying, and soon simply by lending and spending, not even by harvesting and herding. They started paying others to harvest and herd. Instead of being slaves, they started buying slaves. And they had so much money floating around with so many jobs to be filled. Outsiders, non-Jews, became attracted to Israel, and especially to Jerusalem. And to endear themselves to their new Jewish neighbors, these newcomers made gifts to the Lord of the Tabernacle. And similarly, the rulers of the countries around the newly rich Israel sent gifts to the tabernacle. Everybody was pretty superstitious in those days, and superstitious people hedged their karmic bets. You can never really be certain your big stone idol would measure up to the ark that held the formless Lord of Israel, so you better just send some gold and a few oxen to stay on his good side. Suddenly, thanks to David, Israel, Jerusalem, and the tabernacle were on a roll. And under David's son, King Solomon, things really got rolling. Solomon wanted to build a hell of a temple, one that he and the newly mighty people of Israel could be proud of, and did he ever succeed? Solomon's temple was, in every sense of the word, awesome. Awe. These days we have so much wealth, so much grandeur in our modern world, centuries upon centuries of cathedrals being torn down so skyscrapers might be built where they once stood, that we can't really imagine a world without height, without glass and steel walls soaring, without concrete rising so high we need to crane our necks. But the world at that time, at the time of the great miracle and at the time of Solomon, was mostly plain and flat, with nothing very grand at all, particularly the world of the nomadic Jews, whose God required that they never stray too far from the tabernacle. And some Jews might remember tales they'd heard of the great pyramids their forefathers helped to build, but none had ever seen them. No, for these Jews, the tallest things they'd ever seen were mountains and trees and high clouds in the clear sky. Houses were small, one small story high, except in Jerusalem, as more people moved there, an outside staircase to the flat rooftop of a second bedroom. That was a major innovation. The towering walls of Jerusalem would impress no one today. They astonished the Israelites. A walk along Jerusalem's 21-foot walls was dizzying enough. They'd cling to the edges and look down in terror, and the heart-stopping climb of the extra 7 feet to the top of a redoubt tower would be reserved for the cold-blooded city guards and for the young men who wanted to show off for their sweethearts. Modern persons like ourselves would scarcely notice the height. Modern persons, like ourselves, ride glass elevators up the sides of buildings 20 or 30 times that high. While we chit-chat, and we blow our noses, and we complain that there's advertising on the elevator's internet video. So you need to imagine yourself actually living in that ancient time to understand what it was like to see Jerusalem, to understand the awe of seeing Solomon's temple. You need to clear your head of every major structure you have ever seen. No skyscrapers, no office parks, no shopping malls, no stadiums, no universities, no elementary schools, no city halls, no McMansions, no airports, no train tracks, no highways, no planes, trains, or automobiles. No roar of leaf blowers in the morning. No traffic whine. No fog of mercury lamps at the edge of the horizon when the sun goes down. At night, an endless emptiness of sky. And stars big as pearls, so brilliant white they seem to hang just out of reach. And pinprick stars that form clouds of silver light that dance across a sea so black you think you might fall into it. And you need to imagine waking at dawn and walking as the sun rose, and then walking for mile upon mile on a silent, dusty road as it grows light, and seeing nothing but hills of green grass and brown and white outcrop rock, and when you look ahead, you see exactly what you saw behind you. And here and there, an olive tree and one or two gnarled fig trees, and maybe a flock of fat, dirty sheep, a yapping yellow dog chasing some scurrying, bleeding brown goats. Every so often, a dank, still pond surrounded by short, thick date palms, home to dozens of yammering, flapping crows, but not much shade. Otherwise, everything so quiet you can hear a shepherd's reed pipe from miles away. And after an hour of walking, as the sun moves by inches higher in the sky, and another hour, and another, everything, just the same, the always burning sun. So when, at last, you see the white walls of Jerusalem, you blink a little. You rub your tired eyes. And as you walk another hour, and that ring of white stone around the hills of Jerusalem looks no more close than it did an hour before, you realize just how huge what you're seeing must be. And now, despite your weariness, you begin to feel an urgency. Just about the time you first see those white walls, you also notice that the king has planted tall palm trees along the road. And from here to the city, the road is wide and flat and smooth. There's shade from those tall trees, which means your eyes can rest, which means you see more colors, like blue bird wings in the green fronds, tipped with yellow and orange and red. Squat, sand-colored houses cluster along the roadside now. There are wells beside the road, and near the wells, little boys splash in puddles. Dogs chase cats. You can smell bread baking near the houses. The closer you get to the city, the more crowded the road becomes. Suddenly, it seems everyone is coming or going to Jerusalem. Here, the robes women wear are more colorful. Some wear ribbons in their hair. There are ox carts now and donkeys. That means you have to watch your step. If you're fortunate, you reach the city gates in the last afternoon. That's the best time to get there, when the sun is behind you, over your left shoulder, turning the white sandstone walls the color of melting butter. You've been walking on the new King's Road from the south, and now you approach the great south gate. The city walls tower above you. The gateway is the tallest thing you have ever seen built by the hand of man. You have to tilt your head to see the top. You can't believe what you see. Walking above the gate, as if in midair, two guards with bright spears and billowing capes. The sun makes their bronze armor gleam like beaten gold. They chat casually as they stride across the battlements. Have they no fear? The doors of the south gate are made of cypress logs as thick as a man's chest and bound by black iron. Three hinges, each bigger than a house door, secure them to the wall. What's missing from these gates, though? Long iron spikes to face the road? No one in Israel has ever seen an elephant, so no one knows about elephant spikes. They'll be sorry for that someday. Not now, of course, not for centuries, but someday. We'll talk about that. Jerusalem is beautiful. We can't imagine how beautiful. In those days, everything was new. Everything fresh, clean, freshly painted, freshly planted. The best and finest money can buy. It wasn't that way before, and it wouldn't stay that way long, but that's how it was on this perfect day. This is the golden age. 26 centuries later, William Blake would write a hymn about it, David's Royal City. 200 years later, after Blake, Ronald Reagan would speak with tears in his eyes of a shining city on a hill. This is that city. This is that moment. People's hearts would ache for this place and this moment for generations to come, even though all they knew of it was an emptiness, the Jerusalem that was gone and is no more. King Solomon lives in David's royal palace. If possible, he's made it even more beautiful. The marble walls and gates of ebony are open. Blue, sashed guards stand watch beside it. You see it almost as soon as you enter the main city gate. Ahead of you is the royal way. In a few years, this street will be crammed with wine shops and inns and curio shops and brothels, and everyone will call it Temple Street and will have a doubtful reputation. But today, it's a beautiful, wide greensward lined with palms that leads to the Temple Mount. And every morning, Solomon and his wives process on foot with banners unfurled and drums pounding and trumpets bleating up to the tabernacle on the top of Mount Zion. The temple walls look taller than even the city walls, though that might be an illusion, for they're so white that the sun's glare stings the eyes. The stones of the temple walls are huge. How could they even been lifted to such a height? How could each stone be cut so precisely, fitted so perfectly, and then polished so smoothly so the wall has no blemish? How many hands did it take to do that? How many hours? The temple gates are tall and wide, and these are bound in brass that shine like gold. Across the entrance is a single seamless sheet of linen, the biggest piece of weaving ever seen, and it seems not to billow in the breeze like a sail, but rather to breathe, as if the whole temple were breathing, as if the cloth were a veil that hides the face of a shy and beautiful bride. Ahead of you stands the inner gateway that leads to the temple courtyard. The beauty of the temple. So beautiful that even its description would challenge the best of writers, which, as you might have figured out, I am not. The writers of the Tanakh, bless their hearts, just gave up. They simply made a list of its materials. I don't blame them. Tonight, we talk about the temple. We talk about the earthly home of the Lord of Hosts and how it was destroyed. But you need to know the glory of that place, what it meant to the people who built it, the home for their God. To understand the great miracle, you need to get a sense of what was lost. So, pitiful writer that I am, I'm going to take my shot at describing it. There's a famous psychological experiment repeated very often in a lot of different forms. You put a man in a room, sit him in a chair before a table, you put an empty glass on the table and wait an hour and take the glass away. That man's just fine. You put a second man in the same room, and this time put a full glass of water on the table. An hour later, take the glass of water away. Practically speaking, the second man is no worse off than the first, no more thirsty than the first, yet the second man will try to attack you when you move the glass away. Sometimes the second man will threaten to kill you if you try to take away his water. His water. How readily do we humans possess? How deeply do we humans feel loss? And this place of awe, this temple, has there ever been a possession more worthy of the human heart's desire? And for the Jews to have held it in their grasp for centuries and then to have had it destroyed, destroyed so utterly. The whole temple complex was white. Almost miraculously white, relentlessly white. White because of sun and the pale sandstone of Jerusalem, for most of the temple was made of sandstone, and that had been polished smooth so the sun gleamed when it fell on it. But the light of the temple courtyard was like no light on earth. The sunlight wasn't hot, but its brilliance blast into the eyes like the heat of a furnace. So keep that in mind. Light so bright it hurt. Now the form of the new temple reflected the form of the old traveling tabernacle the Jews had used for 100 generations, except that everything in the new temple was on a scale grander and more beautiful than had ever been imagined. For example, the courtyard. The new temple courtyard was the largest enclosure any Jew had ever seen. You like soccer? You prefer American football? Never mind. The new temple courtyard would have been big enough to play a football game right next to a soccer match. Solomon had laid out the new courtyard to be big enough to hold many more than 1 million Jews, and also thousands of sacrificial animals, as well as to hold the massive worship building. And instead of the cloth screen that enclosed the old tabernacle courtyard, the new temple courtyard was surrounded by high walls of polished sandstone. The floor of the temple also was tiled in sandstone. White, 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 white. Now, what inspires awe? Let me tell you, sight. You overwhelm the eyes, and awe will fill the mind. And the temple overwhelmed the eyes as no sight had overwhelmed the eyes before. The Egyptian kings had tried their hand at this centuries before, first by piling stones on top of stones, a great big pyramid. And I grant you it's impressive, but it's just a big pile. And though quite grand, it doesn't inspire awe. Realizing this, the pharaohs had tried a different tack. Giant statues of themselves, 10 times life size or more. The effect worked backwards. Those very impressive stone figures invited one to consider a comparison with their very puny human models. Too bad for the pharaohs, because the viewer would end up rolling his eyes and shaking his head at the comparison. Big statues are very impressive, maybe, but they are not awe-inspiring. No, to inspire true awe, one needs an abstract shape where the viewer sees a form never seen in nature, the Parthenon, for example, or the Pantheon, or the Taj Mahal, shapes not seen before, buildings that shake the foundation of the viewer's world. And the first seriously awe-inspiring building ever built was the Tabernacle of Solomon's Temple. The heart of Solomon's Temple was the Tabernacle, set in the middle of the courtyard. Just as the ancient traveling tabernacle had been a tall tent set in the middle of a tent courtyard, Solomon set a tall stone tower in the middle of a stone courtyard. Solomon's tabernacle was tall, the tallest building any Jew had ever seen, a huge tower sitting on a huge base, 25 feet wide, 40 feet long, and 70 whole feet tall. Now, how big is that? I've been trying to think how to help a modern mind imagine those dimensions. This is the best I can come up with. Imagine your typical double-wide mobile home. You know the kind I mean. A big fancy one. Got one in mind? Now, imagine a second double-wide dropped on top of the first. And another on top of that. Now, that's a stack of double wides. That's 30 feet tall. And that's pretty tall. Taller than most church steeples. Now, imagine a second triple-decker stack. Now, take the whole second stack and place it on top of the first stack. Now you have a 60-foot stack of double wides. Wait, because we're not done yet. We got to have one more double wide on top, and now you have a tower as tall as Solomon's Tabernacle, 70 feet. You know those gas signs on the interstate, the way tall ones you see from more than a mile from the exit? those are 70 feet high, some of them. Some of them are that tall. So picture that tower of double wides. Lean back. Tilt your head back. You see the front door of the top one? You can just make it out way up there, way, way up the top. Remember how it looks. Take a picture in your mind, okay? Now take a long mental walk around the whole stack. It's really tall, isn't it? Ooh, it's 25 feet wide. Wide as a typical house. And when you get to the end, turn the corner and keep walking and keep looking up as you're walking. It's 40 feet long. That's a pretty long walk. That is one big honking stack of double wides. And now we're going to put that pile onto a base. So let's imagine a platform. The tabernacle sat on a stepped base, so let's imagine a stepped platform for our double wides, a wide porch with enough room that our priests can walk around that whole stack. And that means the base of the platform will have to be big, 120 feet around. You have trouble imagining it? That's the size of a typical small town house lot. I went to the College of William & Mary in Williamsburg, Virginia, and William & Mary's frat houses were flat-roofed, two-story brick dorms about 100 foot square. The tabernacle platform was a stepped sandstone platform, 20% wider than one of those frat houses. The top of the platform was the same height as the huge sandstone walls of the temple. So imagine that you've hoisted that big 70-foot-tall stack of double-wides onto the top of that frat house. Imagine how you were craning your neck to see the door on the top of the double-wides before. Well, now the top is even 20 feet higher. Now you really need to lean back to see it. I'm putting this image in your mind for a reason. I do indeed hope that the notion of a giant pancake stack of double wides hoisted onto a frat house stupefies your brain, because stupefied is how the Jews felt when they stepped off the dusty roads of the sparse brown plains and saw the lush hills and palm-lined streets of the royal city, and they saw amidst those holy streets the Holy Temple Mount. And they saw at the top of Mount Zion the gleaming walls of the temple. And they saw the breathing veil of the temple gateway. And they saw the bright, smooth courtyard of the temple. And they saw the wide steps to the tabernacle platform. And then they saw the glistening tabernacle of the Lord towering above them. They saw the grandest thing built by human hands that any human eye had ever seen. It was just as hard for them to integrate what they were seeing into their understanding of the nature of the world as suddenly stumbling onto a stack of double wides hoisted on the roof of a frat house would be for you. But it wasn't just the sheer size of the tabernacle that made it awesome. It was much, much more than its size. Size was only the beginning. Consider the tabernacle's materials, of course, the polished sandstone. But those gleaming, brilliant facings were decorated with abstract graphic designs. Embedded in the bright stone were onyx and carnelian and jasper, and hair-thin bands of gold crisscrossed over the entire surface of the tabernacle, glistening in the afternoon sun as though the whole tower had slipped through a magical spider web, and jeweled threads were still clinging to its surface. Consider the windows and doors of the tabernacle. At the top of the platform, two tall, dark doors of precious cypress, themselves 22 feet tall, opening into the inside of the tabernacle. These doors were framed with carved columns of dark, variegated marble so thick that four grown men could not join hands around them. Except for those doors, the bright walls of the tabernacle seemed to be seamless from the bottom to the very top, where there were four small square windows. Remember where you imagined the very top double wide to have a door way, way up on top? That's where those small windows were, extra small, to make them seem extra far away. And the designers of the tabernacle added yet another trick to make the tower seem even impossibly taller. They gently tapered the edges of the tower, using the taper to give an illusion of perspective and distance. And the small windows weren't really square. They reflected the same angled taper, enhancing to those below the illusion of soaring height. So now the tower seemed maybe twice as high. If you were lucky, you might see the inside when the cypress doors of the tabernacle opened. Those windows set at the very top of the tower would create that really cool sunbeam of the Lord effect. You know what I mean? With light pouring down into the room in a brilliant, narrow, golden stream from above, just like in the movies. Inside the tall doorway, to either side, two enormous graven images. Two enormous painted statues of cherubim. Tall, unfurled eagle wings, lion's bodies, giant swords, fierce, frightening faces, and by enormous, I mean really big, so tall you'd need a ladder to look into their eyes, and the wings covered in gold leaf so they shone in the sunbeams. Graven images of the Lord's guardians to guard what the tabernacle held, the most precious objects in the world. The ever-burning censer of incense, the ever-burning lights of the menorah, the table of showbread, the ever-present offering to the Lord of hosts. And just beyond those holy vessels, long cloth drapes woven with images of cherubim that stretched from the top of the tower to its floor. The drapes that hid the most precious object of all, the Holy of Holies, the mercy seat, the Ark of the Covenant, the earthly throne of the Lord of Heaven. Only priests might enter the tabernacle. So today, we are no different from the Jews who worshipped there 3,000 years ago. Like them, we can only imagine what it was like to be inside. And in my mind's eye, though, I see it all the time now. But those ancient Jews might have caught a glimpse of the tabernacle's interior. When the tabernacle door swung open, they might have seen the fierce painted face of the cherubim and their gold leaf covered wings. But if we had been priests, we could have stepped inside that awesome place. We might have heard the thud of the huge cypress doors echoing through the towers they closed behind us, the sudden dark and quiet as they closed, the vast emptiness of this tall, cavernous spire of that room, the air charged and fogged with incense, the sting of incense in our noses, in our mouths, in our lungs, now beating through our blood, the smoke swirling in a single beam of sunlight so bright it looks almost solid, bathing the whole tower in refracted light diffusing through the incense smoke, and far below that fierce, bright sunbeam, the tiny flickering lights of the menorah's seven oil lamps. Beside them, the showbread loaves, golden, on their golden table, as if any moment someone might come to eat them. And the drapes that shielded the ark, shimmering in the light and shadow, and the muffled quiet of that vaulting space gently moving as if with an unseen breath. It would be as if we had stepped into another world, a world of silence and great space, unlike anything anyone else had ever seen or ever felt, as though we had come into a place where cherubim were real, where fiery seraphim might sing their constant praise, as though we'd stepped into the emptiness that connects heaven with the earth. And this is all that we would see if we were priests. But if you had been the high priest, then consider this. Then once a year, you might see, you might see on Yom Kippur, the Day of Atonement, you might come forward holding in your hand, in a golden bowl, the blood of the scapegoat, and you might walk to the very heart of the tabernacle and step up to the veil and cast the drape aside. Then you might see a sight so rare that only a handful of men who had ever walked on earth had ever seen it. And everyone who had ever seen it before you now was dead. A cloud would gather around the top of the ark and then gather above it. And the cloud would start to glow until you saw within the glowing mist the face of the Most High. The face of the Most High. The face of the Most High. I need to take a breath. Now, the city of Jerusalem alone would have been awe-inspiring. The temple courtyard alone would have been awe-inspiring. The tabernacle and its platform would have been, holy cow, the most awe-inspiring place on the planet. But the temple complex had a lot more going on. First of all, music. And I mean some serious music. The Jews were still high as kites from King David's Psalms. So about 50 yards in front of the steps that led to the tabernacle was a courtyard full of musicians. There stood solo singers, dancers, choirs, harpists, trumpeters, percussionists of every imaginable variety. Psalms echoed constantly from courtyard walls. And between the courtyard of musicians and the grand stairway of the tabernacle was the holy altar of the Lord. And that, I have to say, must have been pretty jaw-dropping. Now, we've seen things like this in our modern day. Every 4 years, they built something roughly the same shape and awesome size for the Olympic flame. Of course, in our day, they build it out of steel or something, and they keep it lit with propane. But that was not so easy for the Jews. The temple altar was a tower built of stone. Huge boulders. Huge chunks of stone. Unhewn stone pulled raw from the earth, each boulder the size of a small sports car. Who knows how the Jews wrangled them together, got them to sit there in a tower 30 feet tall without collapsing. Somehow they managed it. So the top of the stone tower was taller than the tabernacle platform, taller than the temple walls, taller than a church steeple, pretty honking tall. And on top of this huge tower of rock had been set the altar brazier, a great brass bowl, the width and breadth of a good-sized wading pool. The altar fire burned in this brazier continually. It was a big fire. Again, big means big, hot. The grate of the altar would get so hot that they had to forge it from iron, because any softer metal would just melt. That big, hot fire burnt continuously, day and night. That was the job of a special group of priests, and they took it seriously. And it took a lot of wood. I don't know if you can imagine how much wood, but I have an idea of how much. I've been to the burning gates of Varanasi on the Ganges River, where funeral pyres burn day and night. They have monster piles of wood there. Wood in stacks so massive, it looks like blocks of row houses in Brooklyn. That's the amount of wood we're talking about. And that's what I imagine they had at the temple. They had a special gate on the west wall of the temple called the Wood Gate, where wood got carted from a big staging area to the altar. From the sandstone courtyard of the altar, two long, wide ramps of tamped earth had been built. One of these ramps was the wood ramp, and we'll get to the other in a moment. The wood priests made a constant procession along this ramp, carrying wood from the carts up to the fire, and the carts made a constant procession from the wood gate to the ramp. And one of the 12 tribes, a different tribe each month, had to come up with the mountains of wood needed to keep that monster altar fire burning day and night. Just imagine the heat pouring out of the mouth of that enormous brass altar. Imagine the sight of it burning constantly, whipped by the wind in front of that magnificent, tapering sandstone tabernacle that just seemed to reach to heaven. Imagine the flash of yellow and green flames leaping high, the echoes of the roaring fire mixing with the singing and the cymbals and the trumpets and all that sound cascading from the stone walls and stone floors of the courtyard. And now we need to add one more overlay to our mental image of the temple. One last awesome sight, perhaps the most awesome sight of all, because the temple, most of all, was a place of sacrifice. I said earlier that there were two earthen ramps leading to the top of the altar, and one was used for fuel. The other was used by priests carrying sacrifices to the altar fire. They carried sacrifices in large silver trays held over their heads. Dozens of priests walking constantly up that long earth ramp to the blasting fire, bare-chested because the fire was so hot, trays heavy as they hoisted them with grain, with flesh, with fat. And that fire, mighty hot. Fire priests took the sacrifice trays. A tray of grain they'd scatter with a great flourish, and this would make the flames leap up with a sudden whoosh and roar. A tray of fat they'd toss into the middle of the altar's iron grate, and there wet flames would lick it greedily, and thick, dark smoke would pour out. The flesh they'd place near the edge of the brass altar bowl, where the embers were hot, and the flames were low, and the flesh would brown and roast. The flesh they returned to a priest's tray, so it was carried back to the worshippers below. Every day, the Jews brought gifts to the Lord of hosts, to David's holy city, to the holy mountain, to Solomon's temple, to the courtyard, filled with song, and watched as the priests prepared them and carried them and lifted them above their heads before the towering throne that held the mercy seat and carried them to the altar of the Most High, and cast them on the ever-burning flame. The first sacrifice in the morning and the last sacrifice in the evening was a holocaust, a whole burned lamb. And when the priests placed that holocaust upon the fire, they threw in great hands full of salt as well. The salt made great blue flames that roared up high, quite a sight, against the dark sky, and the golden light touching the white stone, the blue flame of the altar fire, the brilliant light of the holocaust. When Solomon dedicated that temple, that magnificent temple, that day was the day of days for the Jews, I think. One of the astonishing days where when it's over, you hit the sack thinking, well, I can keep on living, but that's basically it. I'm never going to have a cooler day than that one. So really, what's the point? The temple was brand new and awesome on that day of days. I hope I have made it seem to you at least a little awesome, because it really was. Imagine how great it felt for the Jews to have that totally sweet temple of their very own after a couple thousand years of running around worshiping the king of the universe in a tent, in a puny, smelly tent. For that matter, imagine how great it felt for the Jews to have a totally sweet nation of their own after a couple of thousand years of running around as nomad tribes fleeing from the invading horde of the month. Imagine how great it was to have that totally sweet city of Jerusalem and a king and a royal palace and an army and a government and all that civilized stuff after a couple of thousand years of acting like something out of the Stone Age. Imagine how great to have all the kings and queens of the border countries coming into the courtyard of that sweet new temple, all kneeling and heads down to Solomon and bringing peace offerings, like, "Oh, Solomon, please don't hurt us." And after a couple thousand years of Jews doing the kneeling, how sweet to see somebody else doing the kneeling for a change. Imagine how great to watch the faces of those kings and queens when they saw the holy temple of the awesome new nation of Israel, and they saw what the Jews and their awesome Lord could accomplish. But on that day, when Solomon dedicated the temple, it wasn't just the kings and queens of many lands who got served. The Jews got something else, too. The Jews got a dose of Shekinah. Remember Shekinah? The presence of the Lord in flame? She came. Did she ever? That huge walled courtyard, that towering tabernacle, that great flaming altar, brilliant in the sunlight, the courtyard filled with kings and queens and practically every Jew in Israel, flames leaping to the sky, voices lifted, echoing in cheers and song, Solomon himself, arms stretched before the open doors of the tabernacle tower, behind the gleaming golden faces and bright wings of the cherubim guardians, glimpses of the veil that hides the ark, Solomon calling on the Lord to bless the temple, and as he calls out, a white cloud above the altar fire rises and turns dark and spreads across the sky and hides the sun, and every eye in the courtyard looks up in fear. Suddenly the dark cloud falls to the earth in a great blue-black ball, and it fills the courtyard space where the tables of sacrifice will go, and it changes from a ball into a tall blue flame flickering, a brilliant flame taller than the altar, stretching so high it seems to reach the very top of the tabernacle. It burns, but does not give off any heat, bright blue, yet you can see right through it. No one, of course, can take their eyes from that blue flame. It rotates, swirls, tightens, until it is no taller than a man. And then it seems to walk or float up the tabernacle steps, lingering for a moment as it reaches King Solomon, then passing into the tabernacle itself, so the cherubim seem lit from within. Then the blue flame passes through the veil that hides the ark, and then from the high windows of the tabernacle, light blasts out in all four directions, as if the tabernacle itself were a beacon to all the earth. And then finally the bright blue light fades in the courtyard, which now everyone realizes was utterly silent and utterly still, returns to some sort of life. Now that, for the Jews, was the Day of Days. Of course, the temple completely changed everything for the Jews. I mentioned this earlier, but I'm not sure it's possible to beat that dead horse adequately. The temple changed everything. Jerusalem changed everything. Almost overnight, there was a new normal, a normal based on living in a city with walls and streets and houses instead of living in a cluster of tents, a normal based on worshiping in a temple built of stone that stayed in one place, that was grand and beautiful, instead of a traveling tent. You never really knew for sure where it was going to be next. A normal based on military might, a confidence that enemy hordes would not be raiding your tent in the middle of the night, that you could tuck your children into bed and find them there the next morning. The Jews were a nation now. The Jews had a king. The promise Hashem had made to Abraham had truly been fulfilled. But here's the final punchline for this night's installment. Something else had changed. The Jews had stopped being a moving target. They had become a big, fat, sitting duck. Allow me to explain. The nomadic Jews always felt like they were being singled out for attack by hostile neighbors. But I think this wasn't how the neighbors saw it. The nomadic Jews didn't have a lot of assets. They were always on the move. Kingdoms with armies like to attack a place that's easy to find, like a city, that has a lot of stuff to pillage when they get there, like a city. The nomadic Jews, to their hostile neighbors, were simply targets of opportunity, not strategic targets. There just happened to be lots of opportunities. Now that David had united them into Israel, now that they had an army and a fortified city, the Jews had pretty much ceased to be a target of opportunity. In the course of years, Jerusalem would become a strategic target, an increasingly vulnerable strategic target. So vulnerable that a day was coming in about 350 years when Jerusalem would be rubbed out, gone. There would be nothing left of the temple, not a stone left standing on that holy mountain. Remember the experiment? How bad the subject felt when the glass of water was taken away? Imagine how he would feel if the experimenter were to spill the water, smash the glass in his face, and take a shit on the table. But I'm getting ahead of myself. Let's get back to the Day of Days before all that happened, when everything was beautiful. Let's see how the seeds of tares were sown amidst the good seeds of Jerusalem. As I described, Jerusalem just sort of showed up one day in the desert, thanks to David. It all happened so fast, but sometimes things do happen fast. There are modern-day analogs to the sudden appearance of Jerusalem and the temple and what had been essentially the wilderness. It brings to mind the sudden appearance of a railway stop in places like East Middle of Nowhere, Wyoming, when the Union Pacific drove west, and how a town and city and metropolis might spring up around it overnight, or how Las Vegas basically showed up out of nowhere when Bugsy Siegel opened the Flamingo Hotel on the day after Christmas in 1946, or how Orlando turned into whatever the hell Orlando is today, thanks to Disney World opening. If you look at a map on the ancient Middle East before David, you'll see this big blank space between Antioch and Alexandria just waiting for Jerusalem. All you need to do is lay down a city and some roads, and most of all, I can't emphasize this enough, a serious tourist attraction, which the temple would surely become, and you've basically guaranteed that Jerusalem would become a metropolis, which it did. The insular tribal Jews, who up until then had practically no dealings with the outside world, a world who cared about them not at all, now suddenly found themselves at a commercial crossroads. Not only that, the temple itself was drawing people from all over the outside world to Jerusalem. The temple was the cool new thing to see. Like I have said repeatedly, it was awesome. There was nothing like it. People wanted to see it. And Solomon anticipated that. His temple courtyard had been laid out so the largest area facing the tabernacle was reserved so Gentiles and others, who technically were not allowed to worship, could see the tabernacle. The people who could afford to make the trek and see the temple for fun were rich. You would need to be rich to make that trip. And the rich people who saw it would be superstitious. I say that confidently because in the world at that point, everybody was superstitious. So, while you were at the temple, since you were rich, you'd probably buy some oxen to sacrifice to the god of the temple just to hedge your bets, just like you spin the slots a few times in Vegas, even if you're not much of a gambler, because why not? You might get lucky. And a rich, superstitious tourist might bring a few gold trinkets to hand off to the temple treasury. The temple treasury certainly started to get quite a few gold trinkets. The rich tourists wanted a nice place to stay, nice things to eat, not mutton and olives and sheep cheese, thank you very much. So the Jews built nice inns with nice feather beds and imported chefs cooking imported foods to cater to rich tourist tastes. They built those inns on the quiet hill that led to the temple so the tourists wouldn't have so far to walk. Soon it became known as Temple Street. The imported chefs and the chefs' wives and kids needed houses, and the feather beds needed fluffing, and the Jews imported maids to fluff them, and the maids brought their husbands and children, and they also needed houses, and all those chefs and maids and family needed food like they had at home, so the import stores sprang up next to their houses and so on. And beautiful as it was, inspiring as the temple was, let's be frank, you can stand and watch the gorgeous dancing fountain lights in front of the Bellagio in Las Vegas, but when you turn around, you're surrounded by an army of pimps, because the only thing tourists want more than food, wine, and a bed is a pleasant new companion to share them. Jerusalem's only material industry was tourism. When you've got a tourist-based economy, which Jerusalem was quickly becoming, let me tell you how it works. There's a fabulously rich part of town that gets cared for by incredibly poor people who live in jaw-dropping poverty. It's that way in every tourist town. The only other businesses in Jerusalem were government and religion. I can't think of a worse place to put the seat of a government or the seat of a religion than in a high-roller tourist town. It's tough for the wives of government official or the wives of priests to watch the wives of touristas driving off in a stretch limousine to a fancy late-night dinner wearing a mink coat and diamond earrings. It's hard for their husbands not to imagine how easy it would be to lay hands on some fast, untraceable cash. It's a bad mix, tourism and government and religion. But that was Jerusalem's mix. I say rich tourists, but who were those tourists? How'd they gotten rich? Merchants, of course, but there would also have been some royalty and government officials of neighboring lands. When they weren't standing awestruck in the courtyard or enjoying the easy delights of Temple Street, they were probably chatting noisily with one another and with the increasingly well-off Jews of Jerusalem in wine shops and cooking up deals. The rich love to cook up deals. And these superstitious foreigners brought with them their beliefs in other gods. At that time, living in the Middle East was like living in an X-Man comic book, populated with gods instead of mutants. So many gods, each with different powers. Hashem may have had a really snazzy temple, but those other gods had cool powers. And a lot of those gods had followers, many of whom, it turned out, were really hot women, the kind that Jewish men seem to go for. Anyway, almost immediately after the Day of Days, things started to go into a nasty, nasty spiral. Solomon's own wife started worshiping idol. Solomon's own wife started worshiping idols, and Solomon went along for the ride. Wise King Solomon, for Pete's sake. And when Solomon died and his son became king, the southern half of Israel seceded and formed its own kingdom, Judah. Bam, just like that. Half of Israel gone. And I just can't stand to talk about the reigns of the next 15 or 20 kings of Israel. They aren't specifically relevant to the great miracles, so I'll just sum up. It's a pattern. A weaker king, followed by a really stupid-ass putz king, then an even stupider-ass putz king, then a kind of mostly benign king who tries to get things back on track, and then the cycle starts again, and it's just a long, horrible, boring spiral down to Blah Town. There's really two surprising elements of the spiral. One surprise is how many of the Asputs kings... One surprise is how many of the Asputs kings actually started setting up idols in the temple. Idols. Idols in the temple. Of course, these Asputs kings were also looting all the gold they could lay their hands on from the temple treasury. I mean, you could pretty much write that story, but it's still discouraging. Gold. That's kind of a given, but really, idols? So, naturally, during the Asputs king periods, prophets would show up and condemn the king and the people for their wicked ways, and there'd be plagues and drought. Famine and boils and whatnot. And naturally, enemies would come and start marauding and looting and reducing the holdings of Israel and generally making things uncomfortable. And the Israelites would be wailing and gnashing their teeth. And eventually, the Asputs would die. And finally, the benign king would come to power and tear down the idol. And things would be okay again for a couple of years. And then it would all start up again. They're just sad, you know. After the Day of Days, just sad, the great military might of Israel was fading. Nobody was scared of Israel anymore. But everybody was getting scared of Babylon. Babylon was on Israel's northern border. A bunch of northern countries had gotten tired of killing each other and finally decided to unite and form Babylon and kill everybody else instead. And they were getting really, really good at it. Babylon was scarier than any other country anyone had ever seen. Babylon made the Philistines look like children. So we'll pick up the story of the great miracle again here as Babylon begins to threaten a weakened Israel. Great hordes of Babylonians are heading south toward Jerusalem. There's a prophet in Israel, Jeremiah, and as you can probably guess, he's running around telling everybody that Hashem is angry at the faithlessness of his people, and he's angry about how they've forgotten his law, and all you need to do is take a walk down Temple Street and you'll know exactly what Jeremiah is all worked up about. Jerusalem is a moral cesspool. Tonight, standing on the temple walls, you can see the campfires of the Babylonian forces. There are thousands of them sitting out there sharpening their swords. The Israelite army has fallen back a dozen times. There is no defendable perimeter except the city walls, and the Babylonians have elephants. That's their secret weapon. The prophet Jeremiah takes matters into his own hands. That faithful final night with a half dozen followers, he breaks into the tabernacle and carries off the Ark of the Covenant under cover of darkness. He takes it out of the temple, out of the city. He takes it to some secret place. The next morning, even the men who hide it with him forget where they have taken it. Jeremiah tells the Jews that the Ark will be recovered when righteous men return to walk upon the earth. The next day, the Babylonians attack. Remember the great city gates of Jerusalem? Well, the Babylonians have brought elephants from India. In India, the gates have long iron spikes so elephants can't ram them, because in India, they know all about elephants. In Israel, no one has seen them before. The elephants tear through the gates like they're paper. They stomp through the streets, trampling people underfoot. They push through the walls of homes and shops, burying families beneath the rubble. They storm up Temple Street, leaving destruction behind them. It looks like a town in Alabama after a tornado. Jews are standing in smoke and ruin with blank, empty stares. By noon, half of Jerusalem is rubble. Rubble. The Babylonians break for lunch. The army has fallen back. They've fled the city. They've given up and are saving their own skins. In Jerusalem, it's every man for himself. By early afternoon, the elephants have reached the temple. While soldiers mill through the temple looking for loot, the elephant masters formed the beasts into clusters. With their great heads joined together, they push against the smooth stone temple walls, and the white stones tumble like children's blocks. They use tow ropes to pull down the altar, because the unhewn stones would hurt the elephant's tender skin. Soon it's just a pile of rocks. They wait until sundown to move on the tabernacle. Everyone wants to be there to see. It's a little dangerous. It takes a little planning. They'd love to see the whole thing pitch over like a chopped down tree, but it's made of blocks, so that's not actually what would happen. If they set the elephants pushing at the bottom, the falling blocks would crush them. But there's a smart fellow who figures out the method. Long, thick ropes attached at different heights, pulled from the corners of the courtyard so the tower tumbles down in pieces. He's figured it out. So it all falls at once, quite dramatically. And just like that, everything is gone. The tabernacle, the ark, the stone tablets, the altar, the temple, even Jerusalem. The Babylonians have commandeered a few thousand women. They have had them bring some jugs of wine and food and, of course, beds and blankets to the courtyard. They made them watch the tabernacle fall. They got a big kick out of their tears. There's plenty of wood at the temple. They'll use it for bonfires. No one's going to be using it for sacrifices. Now that the day's work is over, now that the city of Jerusalem has been completely demolished, now that there is nothing left to destroy, the Babylonians are patting themselves on the back and throwing a little victory party right there on Mount Zion. They're going to stay up all night, and everyone is going to have a great good time. The men will have a good time anyway. Tomorrow, the Babylonians will round up all the Jews they can find and march them north to Babylon as slaves. The Jews are going to be captives for the next 80 years. The lucky ones are on the run right now. But among the ones that remain, some are already beginning to wonder. If the promised land is gone, and the tabernacle's gone, and the ark's gone, what remains of the covenant? What remains of the law? What does it mean to be a Jew? The Jews are starting to realize that Hashem has abandoned them. The Jews are about to wander in the wilderness again. And this time, there will be no ark to lead them. The end.